On this June 9th, this is Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio. I'm Steve Scully. Thanks for joining us. And here are some of your Wednesday headlines. President Biden in England tonight for his first foreign trip, the G7 summit, followed by meetings with European Union leaders, and in 1 week, Russian President Vladimir Putin. Collectively, a series of high-stakes meetings. Before leaving this morning, the president telling reporters one of his top priorities to strengthen alliances with European and Japanese leaders. By the way, the chartered press plane that preceded the president's departure delayed for hours overnight when cicadas affecting one of the plane's power units delayed the departure. The plane was awaiting takeoff at Dulles Airport outside of Washington, D.C. And even when he left this morning, President Biden had a swat of cicada off his shoulder shortly before boarding Air Force One. Also today, unused doses of Johnson & Johnson's one-shot COVID vaccine piling up on state shelves, and now hundreds of thousands of doses in danger of expiring. In fact, more than 21 million doses of the J&J vaccine have been distributed around the country, but according to the CDC, just over a half had been administered. Senator Shelley Moore Capito telling Fox News that she was frustrated and disappointed that the White House kept moving the goalposts, those are her words, after the infrastructure negotiations with the president fell apart yesterday. Meanwhile, a group of House members today coming up with their own plan, the price tag just over $1 trillion. Just some of the stories shaping Washington today. It's all ahead here on C-SPAN Radio. And we begin with the president, who arrived in Great Britain ahead of the G7 summit that will take place in Cornwall, England later this week, marking his first official overseas trip as president. Tomorrow, he will hold a series of one-on-one meetings with the British Prime Minister Boris Johnson, the G7 conference beginning on Friday. After the summit, which includes leaders from Canada, Japan, France, Germany, and Italy, the President and First Lady meeting with Queen Elizabeth. That will take place at Windsor Castle this weekend, then off to Belgium and Switzerland next week. So a busy 8-day schedule for President Biden. He previewed the week ahead during his speech as he spoke to U.S. troops stationed in southern England.
And now we need to modernize our alliance, investing in our critical infrastructure, our cyber capabilities, and to keep us secure against every threat we faced over the last decade and the new challenges we're about to face as well. With the European Union leaders, I'll discuss how the United States can work with Europe to address a full range of issues that require the full strength of our transatlantic partnership, including working together to shape the new rules for the 21st century economies. And only after these meetings, with our closest democratic partners, to develop a common agenda and renewed purpose, I'll travel to Geneva to sit down with the man I've spent time with before, President Vladimir Putin. We're not seeking conflict with Russia. We want a stable, predictable relationship. Our two nations share incredible responsibilities, and among them, ensuring strategic stability and upholding arms control agreements. I take that responsibility seriously, but I've been clear. The United States will respond in a robust and meaningful way when the Russian government engages in harmful activities. We've already demonstrated that. I'm going to communicate that there are consequences for violating the sovereignty of democracies in the United States, in Europe, and elsewhere. I'm going to be clear that the transatlantic alliance will remain vital, a vital source of strength for the UK, Europe, and the United States. I'm going to make sure there's no doubt as whether the United States will rise in defense of our most deeply held values and our fundamental interests. Here's why this all matters so much right now. I believe we're in an inflection point in world history, the moment where it falls to us to prove that democracies will not just endure, but they will excel as we rise to seize the enormous opportunities of a new age.
The president speaking to U.S. troops upon his arrival in southern England in advance of the G7 summit. And during question time earlier today in London, the Labour Party leader, Keir Starmer, calling on the Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, to take the lead at the G7 this weekend and make the global vaccinations program a reality. It is, by the way, one of the overarching goals during the summit talks in Cornwall, England. Later this week, by the way, the president is expected to announce plans to purchase 500 million additional doses of the Pfizer vaccine and to donate those doses to other countries. More from the House of Commons earlier today.
Mr. Speaker, I now want to turn to this week's G7. This will be the first major summit of the since the recovery. The UK needs to lead, not just to host. The priority must, of course, be a clear plan to vaccinate the world. As the Delta variant shows, nobody is safe from this virus until everybody is safe. The Prime Minister has made big promises on this, but it needs a truly global effort to make it happen. So will the Prime Minister take the lead at the G7 and do whatever is necessary to make global vaccinations a reality?
Yes, indeed, Mr. Speaker. And actually, I think what the people in this country also understand is that not only were we able to give one of the first authorizations for the AstraZeneca, the Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine, but also thanks to the deal the government did between the Oxford scientists and AstraZeneca, we were able to ensure that one in three of the 1.5 billion doses that have been distributed around the world are the Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine. That is global Britain in action, to say nothing of the billion vaccines that we hope to raise from the G7 this week.
That from the House of Commons earlier today in London. And the Washington Post has this headline: is there a special relationship building between Biden and Boris or not? Dan Balls is the chief political correspondent for the Washington Post. You go in great detail answering that question. What is your answer?
Not yet, I guess is the short answer. Superficially, yes, they have a very good relationship, as all prime ministers and presidents do. And I mean, it's part of the requirement of the job to have a continuing and strong relationship between the two countries, and, you know, dubbed the special relationship. And President Biden and Prime Minister Johnson give every indication that that's the case here. But we know that over history, there have been some special relationships between presidents and prime ministers, Churchill and FDR, and certainly Thatcher and Reagan, and Tony Blair and Bill Clinton, and Tony Blair and George W. Bush. And those transcended sort of the normal relationship. And I don't know that we have a sense yet of whether Biden and Boris Johnson will get to that point, or whether theirs will be a more customary kind of polite and useful relationship.
And you talk about some of those relationships, including most notably Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan, politically aligned, the same with Tony Blair and Bill Clinton. Of course, with President Biden, really opposites when it comes to some policies to Boris Johnson. So how do the two get there?
Well, that's a good question, Steve. They are very much opposites. I mean, Biden is, you know, I mean, they're different generations. Biden is older. Boris Johnson is certainly much younger. They come from different political parties. Their styles are very much different. I mean, Boris Johnson is a very shrewd and formidable politician, but he's not a policy person. People I've talked to who know him say that, you know, attention to detail is not the first thing you would think about with Boris Johnson. Whereas Biden, by dint of his many years in public service, and I think his knowledge of so many issues and his his effort to get himself briefed up for weeks like this, these meetings that he's got, just make them very, very different. Another point, Steve, is that Boris Johnson, until Biden was elected, was an ally and in some ways an acolyte of Donald Trump. Donald Trump was kind of openly promoting him to be prime minister at a time when Theresa May was still the prime minister of Britain, and she and Trump did not get along well. And he and Boris Johnson did. And so Johnson has had to make, you know, a necessary pivot now that Biden is president, to show his determination to have a constructive relationship. And the White House has signaled that's very much in their, you know, in their interest also. But they're such different people, and they don't have, you know, in the way that Thatcher and Reagan did, they don't have a natural kind of project. Thatcher and Reagan ushered in conservative eras in their two countries, and Blair and Bill Clinton basically were rejuvenating political parties, the Labour Party in Britain and the Democratic Party here, with centrist ideas after a series of losses in general elections. Biden and Boris Johnson share none of those things. So the question is, what is it that really brings them together?
We're talking with Dan Balls of the Washington Post, and personalities aside, the issues and the complexity of those issues also complicating the relationship, and I guess most notably, as you write about, the issue of Brexit.
Yes, Brexit's a very, potentially very difficult issue for the two leaders to get past, because Johnson was obviously pro-Brexit, pro-leave in the campaign in 2016, and Biden and then Vice President and President Obama were very much against it. They felt it was not in the interest of the UK and not in the interest of the EU and not in the interest of the United States. So they're on different sides on that. And there's another aspect of that that it's too complicated to go into in the short amount of time we have. But it has to do with the border between Ireland and Northern Ireland. And this has become, has long been a sticking point in the negotiations between the EU and the United Kingdom, but it threatens to disrupt the Good Friday Accords, which brought peace to Northern Ireland after so many years of the troubles there. And Biden, who obviously is of Irish descent, feels very, very strongly about this, that nothing should happen in these continuing negotiations over Britain's departure from the EU that would disrupt the Good Friday agreements. And he has been very clear and very blunt about that from the beginning. And ironically, this issue has flared again just as Biden is arriving in the United Kingdom, with some very tense negotiations between the EU and the UK, again, related to Ireland and Northern Ireland. So that's a sticking point. Now, presidents and prime ministers have differed on things, even those who have had the best of relationships. But it's an indication, again, of the kind of potential obstacles that make it more difficult for these two men to go from a customary relationship to something that we'll look back in history and say that was a very important relationship.
And so I guess, to use your words, is it safe to assume that the two, the president and the prime minister, will have a cordial, perhaps a warm relationship, but also a very pragmatic relationship?
I think that's right, and I mean there's a mutual self-interest for this week to go very well. Johnson is chairing the G7 meeting, and this is Biden's first trip as president overseas, and his first kind of debut on the world stage as president. So everything says that they want this to go well. I think beyond that, they will have that kind of relationship that you're talking about. But the question in my mind is, does it go beyond that? And that's the unanswerable question at this relatively early stage in the two leaders getting to know one another.
And, of course, our listeners can read it online at WashingtonPost.com and in the newspaper. Dan Balls, here in Washington, chief political correspondent. As always, we thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Steve.
Also today, Dr. Anthony Fauci asking the American public to again get vaccinated, pointing to the Delta coronavirus variant that is spreading across Great Britain. The variant was first identified in India. It does account for more than 6% of the sequenced viruses now here in the U.S., but it is hitting the U.K. even harder. Dr. Fauci saying that the two-dose vaccines from Pfizer or Moderna remain key to fighting it off. He, of course, serves as the president's chief medical advisor and in recent weeks has been facing growing criticism. He was asked about those attacks earlier today, aimed against him and others in the science community. His appearance on MSNBC with Chuck Todd.
You are now getting attacked. As you know, many state public health officials have quit their jobs over the last year because of the unrelenting attacks that have taken place, and now you're at the focal point. What is your level of concern that we're going to discredit public health officials to the point of, look at Russia. They actually have a good vaccine, and none of their citizens will take it because they don't trust their own government.
Right. It's very dangerous, Chuck, because a lot of what you're seeing as attacks on me, quite frankly, are attacks on science, because all of the things that I have spoken about consistently from the very beginning have been fundamentally based on science. Sometimes those things were inconvenient truths for people, and there was pushback against me. So if you are trying to get at me as a public health official and a scientist, you're really attacking not only Dr. Anthony Fauci, you're attacking science, And anybody that looks at what's going on clearly sees that. You have to be asleep not to see that. That is what's going on. Science and the truth are being attacked.
Dr. Anthony Fauci made his comments earlier today on MSNBC, and there is this headline from The Atlantic. The fundamental question of the pandemic is shifting. We understand how this will end, but who bears the risk that remains? Questions posed by Ed Yong. He is a writer for The Atlantic. How do you answer that question?
I think that the problem throughout the pandemic has been that Americans have taken this very individualistic stance. People have looked, thought about their own personal risk and forgotten about the risks of their neighbors, their colleagues, the more vulnerable people in society. And now, as the people who had earliest and easiest access to the vaccines have some degree of immunity and are going back to their previous lives, the people who aren't vaccinated, including some of those most vulnerable sectors of society, are still bearing the collective risk of the pandemic. The pandemic always has been a collective problem, but that problem has increasingly become shifted to people with the least resources and the least privilege.
A couple of points from your essay, which, by the way, is available at theatlantic.com. First of all, the significance of the CDC announcement on May 13th.
So the announcement changed the guidelines about whether people should wear masks indoors and argued that vaccinated people should be free to take off their masks in most indoor places. And the consequence of that, which I think was highly predictable, was that it sent a cultural signal that masking was no longer needed more broadly and that the pandemic was, quote unquote, over. A lot of people reacted to that. A lot of states lifted their mask mandates wholesale. A lot of businesses removed their mandates, resorting instead to an honor system, which doesn't really make any sense in a situation where it's impossible to verify who is vaccinated or not. The result of this is that it centers people who have been vaccinated, but leaves an alert to the half of Americans who have not been, including young children, including immunocompromised people, and including a lot of Black and Latino communities who have been the least vaccinated, who have been among the least vaccinated groups.
And you also point out a number of areas where you say the U.S. has failed or ignored steps that could have made a difference, such as better ventilation, improved sick pay policies, and free accommodations for those people who needed to isolate themselves. Can you explain further?
Yeah, many of the measures that would have made a difference to the collective good, the measures that public health, the discipline that looks after the health of populations, have been advocating for over a year now, have just been abandoned. We can even think about the way tests have been rolled out. The U.S. testing strategy was entirely focused on diagnosing whether specific individuals have been infected or not. But to do testing in a sort of public health population-wide way, you would really want to screen random sectors of the community to see where the virus was, how common it was, and then and do so in a way that allows people to work out if they are contagious in real time. The tests that would have allowed us to do that, rapid antigen testing, have been available for a long time, but just have never been deployed in the way that they could have been. And again, this reflects our very individualistic approach to healthcare, where we focus on the needs of specific people rather than of entire communities and rather than centering equity.
And as you write, during a pandemic, no one's health is fully in their own hands. So moving forward, based on what we've learned in the last year and a half, what will the summer and early fall look like from your perspective?
So the situation is clearly improving. Rates are going down. Vaccinations are rising. But vaccinations are also plateauing. And half the country, as I said, still hasn't been vaccinated. And that means that significant proportions of Americans are vulnerable, and more so than they were last year because of the rise of more transmissible variants. The problem that I think a lot of people fail to appreciate is that Unvaccinated people aren't randomly distributed among the community. They tend to cluster according to geographical and social factors, which means that there are now going to be pockets of vulnerability among communities and within states that allow for outbreaks of the virus, of new and more transmissible variants of the virus, to spread. And I think that that's going to be a problem, because if a lot of America starts feeling like the pandemic is over, they're going to neglect the large numbers of people who will still be affected by it.
So are you saying we're trying to return to normalcy too quickly?
Yeah, I think we are. I think that from the start, the question on people's minds has always been, how will the pandemic end? But I think we now need to ask a different question. For whom is the pandemic still not over? And the answer at the moment is for a large proportion of the country. Again, many of the most vulnerable parts of the country, many of the most marginalized groups, are still lacking the protection of the vaccine, and now lacking the protection of collective actions like mass masking that they could previously count on.
Ed Yong writes for The Atlantic. He's joining us here in Washington. Thank you for your perspective. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
At the closing bell on the big board, a third straight day of losses for the Dow, losing nearly 153 points. The NASDAQ was off by 13. The S&P down 7. A new study by the Urban Brookings Tax Policy Center putting a number on what America's wealthiest could potentially face if Congress approves those Biden tax hikes. According to the report released earlier today, the top 1% would see their federal taxes rise by more than $213,000. The plan also would give low-income households earning less than $26,000 a year an average tax cut of about $600. And if you make less than $92,000 a year, your tax cut would be approximately $300. Also today, the House Judiciary Committee releasing the transcript of its June 4th interview with the Trump White House counsel, Don McGahn. It is the culmination of a two-year court fight that Democrats waged against the Trump administration. They sought to put Don McGahn on the record before the House Judiciary Committee to look at some of the more pivotal moments from the Trump presidency, including when then-President Trump directed Don McGahn to fire then-special counsel Robert Mueller. The full transcript, it's available on our homepage at cspan.org. You're listening to Washington Today. And welcome back. This is Washington Today for Wednesday, June the 9th. I'm Steve Scully. Here are some of your other headlines. President Biden today rescinding former President Trump's executive orders that sought to effectively ban the Chinese-owned video app TikTok. Instead, it replaces it with new guidelines for assessing apps' potential risk of U.S. data. And in another expected reversal, The Washington Post is reporting this evening that the Biden administration is set to toss out former President Trump's efforts to scale back the number of streams, marshes, and other wetlands that fall under federal protection. That will kick off a legal and regulatory battle over the fate of wetlands and waterways around the country. More on that story at WashingtonPost.com. In testimony on Capitol Hill today, the Attorney General Merrick Garland defending a series of arguments made by the Justice Department in recent weeks that endorsed some of the legal positions held by former President Trump, as well as previous administrations. The Attorney General was pressed to explain those moves while testifying before several Senate subcommittees. Specifically, he was asked about the department's support for arguments related to an assault allegation against former president and the release of a memo regarding the handling of the Mueller investigation. Here's part of the Q&A with Vermont Senator Patrick Leahy.
Now, Attorney General, in the past few weeks, your department has endorsed some highly controversial positions taken by the former president's Justice Department. Many have expressed concerns about that. For example, the Trump DOJ removed from the state court to federal court a defamation charge involving an assault allegation against Donald Trump by a woman. The release of the OLC memo on obstruction of justice conclusions and so on. How is this coming about? Are these criticisms valid, or what do you say about them?
Senator, I'm grateful for you asking me the question, and I know about the criticisms. Look, the job of the Justice Department in making decisions of law is not to back any administration, previous or present. Our job is to represent the American people. And our job in doing so is to ensure adherence to the rule of law, which is the fundamental requirement of a democracy or a republic or a representative democracy. And the essence of the rule of law is what I said when I accepted the nomination for Attorney General. It is that like cases be treated alike, that there not be one rule for Democrats and another for Republicans, that there not be one rule for friends and another for foes. Now, it is not always easy to apply that rule. Sometimes it means that we have to make a decision about the law that we would never have made and that we strongly disagree with as a matter of policy. But in every case, the job of the Justice Department is to make the best judgment it can as to what the law requires. Now, matters of policy, of course, are completely different, and that explains why we have reversed policies of the previous administration many times over the last 3 months, and why we have initiated our own policies that are distinctly different from those of the previous administration. But this is an important issue, the distinction between law and policy, and it's at the center of ensuring adherence to the rule of law, for which the Justice Department stands.
That from the Attorney General, Merrick Garland, and questions from Democratic Senator Patrick Leahy. Meanwhile, the Treasury Department was asked about law enforcement authorities to investigate the disclosure of tax records, citing in a media report that showed that some of America's richest people paid little to no income taxes. It was the media outlet ProPublica that obtained a vast trove of IRS data on the tax returns of thousands of the nation's wealthiest individuals, covering more than 15 years. Now, the data includes billionaires like Amazon founder Jeff Bezos and the founder of Tesla, Elon Musk, paying no federal income taxes for a number of years. Now, yesterday, as we covered here on the C-SPAN networks, White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki was asked about that. She said, quote, "Any unauthorized disclosure of confidential government information is illegal." Well, today the issue came up with Senator Susan Collins of Maine and this line of questioning to the Attorney General.
Does the Department of Justice have any information about the origin of this breach, and what steps is the department taking to investigate, identify, and apprehend those responsible?
Senator, I take this as seriously as you do. I very well remember what President Nixon did in the Watergate period. The creation of enemies lists and the punishment of people through reviewing their tax returns. This is an extremely serious matter. People are entitled, obviously, to the greatest privacy with respect to their tax returns. To be honest, I know nothing more about this than what I read in the ProPublica piece, which I also read and was astonished. Now, what I did read in that piece was that the director of the IRS is on it, and he said that their inspectors were working on it. And I'm sure that that means it will be referred to the Justice Department. And when this was on my list of things to raise after I finished preparing for this hearing. And I promise you it will be at the top of my list.
And that from the Attorney General. One additional note, the Hollywood Reporter has confirmed that the Attorney General will meet with top executives from CNN, the New York Times, and the Washington Post. That meeting, led by Attorney General Garland, will take place on Monday. This, of course, following the revelation that prosecutors for the Department of Justice sought email and phone records for journalists at news outlets. The Trump administration, under then-Attorney General William Barr, initially requesting the records, but the Biden administration continued the practice. The request for those records, part of a leak investigation with the Department of Justice, seeking to uncover who leaked that information to the journalists and whose records were requested. Also, this new report from the Inspector General in the Interior Department, U.S. Park Police did not clear Lafayette Park and the nearby area of protesters back on June 1st of 2020, so President Trump could walk from the White House to St. John's Church, but learned of his interest in surveying the site hours after they already begun planning to clear the area in order to put up new fencing. The office has also concluded that the park police officers did act within their authority to begin clearing Lafayette Park and the nearby area at about 7 p.m. for a curfew, a move that ABC News points out, quote, was widely criticized at the time as having contributed to the chaos and confusion at the scene. More details at abcnews.com. Now to the congressional debate over a massive infrastructure bill one day after talks ended between President Biden and Republican Senator Shelley Moore Capito. Her Democratic colleague in West Virginia, Senator Joe Manchin, resisting growing pressure from his fellow Democrats to go it alone on President Biden's proposed $2.3 trillion tax and spending plan. And on Fox News earlier today, Tennessee Senator Marsha Blackburn was asked where things stand between Congress and the White House, Democrats and Republicans.
All right. Well, everybody wonders what the price tag of this infrastructure bill is going to be. I know you've received an invitation from the Vice President Kamala Harris to meet with other female senators as a rather recent tradition. By the way, do you plan to attend that, Senator?
I do plan to attend that. We'll be there and look forward to weighing in that we need an infrastructure bill that is about roads and bridges and highways and airports and ports and broadband.
Does it include climate change?
No, it does not.
Really interesting. I know you and I have had a chance to talk that it's a lot of this has been about the dollar amount when it comes to infrastructure. Yes. And to see these talks break apart, we're left wondering what happens next. Real quick, final thought, Senator.
Well, Senator Capito did an admirable job of leading the discussion on our side of the aisle. I think what this shows is that President Biden is not going to take any kind of compromise. Mm. He wants what he wants. Their definition of infrastructure is evolving. They are wanting to include all sorts of other and extraneous items. And what the American people want is infrastructure. If they want great infrastructure right now ready to build, go build the wall on the southern border.
That from Republican Senator Marsha Blackburn on Fox News earlier today. Meanwhile, a bipartisan group of House moderates today unveiling their own 8-year, $1.25 trillion infrastructure plan designed to help break the impasse over any type of legislation. Now, the framework offered by 58 members of what's called the Problem Solvers Caucus, calling for more than $959 billion for traditional infrastructure, including highways, bridges, rails, airports, and waterways, and another $25 billion of that money set aside for electrical vehicle infrastructure, including electric buses. The plan also calls for about $74 billion to improve drinking water and wastewater systems and $45 billion for upgrades to broadband. Now, the Senate also continuing its own talks. Here is Delaware Democrat Tom Carper earlier today on MSNBC.
Well, as it turns out, there are 10 Republicans who voted in the committee that I chair, the Environment and Public Works Committee. They voted last month in favor of major investments in water infrastructure for drinking water, for wastewater sanitation. We reported a bill out of our committee. It passed the Senate 89-2. So we've already taken, we've got a strong bipartisan position on what to do with respect to water infrastructure. We reported out of our committee, Senator Capito and I lead the Committee on Environment and Public Works, reported out unanimously surface transportation, roads, highways, bridges with a strong climate title. Yeah. That's waiting for Senate action by the full Senate. So in the meanwhile, I'm delighted to see these talks are going on with the president, Senator Capito, and others. We have a number of like rump groups that are emerging, and I think let a thousand flowers bloom. I would just remind them that some good bipartisan work's already been done in water infrastructure, and some very good bipartisan work has been done in roads, highways, bridges, and climate. Don't waste that. Use that as a foundation.
That with Senator Tom Carper on MSNBC earlier today. The president of the NCAA, Mark Emmert, telling Congress today that some state laws and federal proposals that would govern college athlete compensation would fundamentally alter intercollegiate athletics and make it nearly unrecognizable, in his words. His testimony offering a window into the debate on the issue. Today's hearing, the fifth time lawmakers had convened a session looking at how athletes should earn money from their name, their image, and likeness, often referred to as NIL, N-I-L. More from his opening statement.
Over the last decade, I've had the pleasure and privilege of serving as the president of the NCAA, which supports more than 500,000 student athletes who participate in sports every year on 19,000 different teams. The 1,200 colleges and universities of the NCAA are right now in the process of passing historic rules to allow new opportunities for student athletes to be compensated for the use of their name, image, and likeness. These opportunities will allow student athletes to take advantage of the evolving landscape in multiple ways, and our schools intend to pass those rules as quickly as possible, preferably before the end of the month. Like you, we also seek a level playing field that provides NIL opportunities for all college athletes in all the states and in a fair manner. This task is made virtually impossible by the many different name, image, and likeness laws that are passed at the state level, along with the ongoing recurring litigation threats. However well-intentioned the multiplicity of state laws are, they confuse rather than clarify the NFL landscape. This is why we are urging Congress to pass legislation creating a single national NIL standard. The schools that make up the NCAA membership have committed to allowing NIL opportunities to student athletes, and as you well know, our schools develop NCAA rules through a representative process that's not at all unlike the legislative processes in every state in the union.
That with Mark Emmert, the president of the NCAA, and again, NIL, a reference to name, image, and likeness. As he mentioned, Congress continues to debate the issue. Meanwhile, 18 states have passed their own laws to govern how athletes can earn money from their name, image, and likeness, five of which take effect on July 1st. We'll learn more about one of those states, California, in just a moment. But more from today's hearing, Senator John Thune of South Dakota.
I'm interested in hearing from you about what you think a proposal that should become law, if that's what we have to do, given the fact that states are now acting in the absence of NCAA action. And obviously, conferences don't follow state lines. We've got lots of multi-state conferences that could have different laws in place. So it seems to me that, you know, now we're in a position where we have to do something. But what we do is still a point of discussion. There are a couple of proposals I think you may be aware of that have been introduced by members of the Senate. I'm interested in your thoughts about either or both of those, and there may be perhaps others, but more than anything else, I just think that you're in a much better position to guide this process in terms of what a potential set of rules might look like than maybe we are. But I've been very interested in this discussion we're just having about employer-employee. And I think, Dr. Emmert, you mentioned that in your written statement, at least, that you didn't think that you couldn't support anything that would essentially create an employer-employee relationship. And I would just ask you to sort of reiterate your view on why that's something that you prerequisite for legislation.
Yeah, thank you, Senator Thune. The issue of employment status versus being a student, traditional student athlete, as that's been defined historically, is really at the core of what college sports is all about. If student athletes are classified as employees of their university, their college or university, it is, as Senator Schatz pointed out, it does change very fundamentally the nature of that relationship. It moves student athletes out from underneath the guise of education law, for example, to employment law. I believe that's what the good senator was alluding to. And for one, that means Title IX is no longer relevant to college athletics because that's education law, not employment law. It changes the relationship between Coach Few and as a student athlete, as coach student to employer employee. It changes everything about what college sports really is and why we have created college sports 120 some years ago. So everybody in higher education sees that question as one of the core issues to defining college sports versus professional athletics.
Today's hearing that included the head of the NCAA before the Senate Commerce Committee. And as mentioned, this debate comes as a number of states, 18 in fact, already putting in place laws that allow athletes to earn money off their skills. And California is considering a bill that would essentially fast-track some of those reforms. The plan would allow players to make money from endorsements as early as next month. That's because the state already passed a bill that would allow athletes to be compensated, but right now that bill doesn't take effect for another 2 years. For more details, we spoke earlier today to Melody Gutierrez. She is a political reporter for the LA Times based in Sacramento.
Yeah, so California is already set to allow college athletes to be compensated for the use of their name, image, and likeness. But that doesn't start until 2023. That's a bill that has already been signed by the governor and is on the books. However, with five states already set to have their own laws around this area be effective July 1st, the state is now looking at a bill that would essentially move that date up. So that date could be as soon as June, but more likely they're going to look at an urgency bill that would be passed in the next couple months that would be effective immediately. So California still could be behind those five other states, but potentially could jump ahead of the line depending on how fast lawmakers move this bill through.
As you know, this issue is being debated here in Washington. Can you give us a sense of how the debate unfolded in Sacramento and across California?
This is one of the bills that has bipartisan support. It's been flying through the legislature with support from all sides. But where you're seeing the opposition is from schools here in California that are saying, you know, hold on, this is happening too fast. Surprisingly, community colleges have jumped on board and said, you know, that they do support this. They were exempt from the original bill that California passed. But after a task force met, they decided that they wanted to be included in this bill. And so they're being added to this bill and have had support. But the NCAA certainly has been fighting this bill along with some of the universities here in California.
And as you point out, antitrust cases before the U.S. Supreme Court. So this really is reaching all branches of government here in Washington and certainly in California.
Absolutely. This is a bill that has a lot of attention from all different facets here in California. The government is looking hard at this and whether they need to improve the timeline for what California is currently scheduled to do in order to make it to where you're not having piecemeal state by state looks at different ways of approaching this this issue of name, image, and likeness. And California, honestly, they were the first state to pass this bill. And I think that there is a sense of they don't want to then fall behind the other states, whether it's a competitive disadvantage for the state schools here. I think there's also just this issue of California led in passing this first, and they want to ensure that they remain ahead of the pack.
Even the name of the legislation, the Fair Play to Pay Act, Governor Newsom supporting this legislation in his bill signing ceremony, what did he say?
Yes, so when this bill originally passed, the governor was very out front in supporting this. There was a press conference with some high-level athletes that he signed this in front of, and including the NBA's LeBron James, WNBA's Diana Taurasi. So there was a lot of support from the governor who talked about this being about equity, about fairness, and then he said, and it's about time. So I think that there's a lot of anticipation that he will support this bill, but he has not specifically commented on this new legislation, which is pretty standard. He doesn't comment on a lot of legislation that's still going through the legislative process.
But if you could explain what the NCAA is saying when they are calling it, quote, unconstitutional and a scheme.
Yeah, so I think that their concern is that, this will create a different system than the what is known now, that this is a system that is meant for it to be about student athletes and not to create a professionalism by allowing for these for the athletes to be paid. And so I think that there's a lot of concern from the NCAA about how this changes the entire sport and how it affects each different each individual sport as well. So there's I know that the NCAA president Mark Emmert has said that he just believes that the different state-by-state proposals also create a different system. He's called it, the proposals nearly unrecognizable, or the changes that it would make unrecognizable to what, the typical belief that the NCAA represents. And so it's certainly an interesting issue of how this will specifically change the outlook and the opportunities that students have.
This is the headline at LATimes.com. California could fast-track endorsement deals for NCAA college athletes. The reporting of Melody Gutierrez. She's joining us from Sacramento. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
And a reminder, never miss an episode of Washington Today. It's available as a podcast. Listen and follow wherever you get your favorite podcast. Be sure to follow us on Twitter at C-SPAN Radio and all of our coverage online anytime at cspan.org. I'm Steve Scully for the Wednesday edition of Washington Today, hoping you enjoy the rest of your evening.